funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to make people laugh, and what sort of power goes along with that ability? My guests today have been refining their skills for years, working in local clubs and across the U.S., and while they make it look easy, they take their jobs very seriously. Paul Varghese has been called best stand-up comic in Dallas by the Dallas Observer and performed on Comedy Central, Showtime, and NBC's Last Comic Standing. Aaron Aryanpour is currently a finalist in the Funniest Comic in Texas competition. He's performed at the Great American Comedy Festival and was named to Maxim Magazine's list of Real Men of Comedy. You can see them both and a number of other noted comedians at the Backdoor Comedy New Year's Eve Extravaganza at 8 o'clock on December 31st. Guys, welcome back to Think.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us back.
So I think it's been about 2 years since you were here last time, and I'm curious about what's changed since then, not so much with regard to where you're working, but what you're working on.
Go ahead. Can I answer? I'll answer for Aaron.
Please.
Okay.
No, I think for me personally, I'm trying to write out of where I think people pigeonhole me, if that mm-hmm. makes any sense. I'm doing a lot of industry showcases now, and so I'm trying to guess what industry wants from me, which is an impossible battle anyway, and I don't know why I stress over it, but I always feel like people pigeonhole me, whether it be ethnicity-wise, whether it be I'm low-key, whether it be whatever, and so I've been trying to expand myself and write out of my comfort zone, I mm-hmm. guess, which is really hard for me because it doesn't really click with the audience yet, but over the last couple of months, it's sort of been, I don't know.
Is it more irritating to you to be pigeonholed as like the Indian comedian than the low-key comedian?
The low-key thing really bothers me mm-hmm. because it's just how I talk. I'm not trying to be low-key. It's just, I don't even think I'm low-key. I'm sometimes, depending, you know, on my mood, I'm in super energetic mode. It's just, I'm not trying to be anything that I'm not. Mm-hmm. So the ethnic thing doesn't really bother me because I don't really get it that much anymore. Mm-hmm. People just kind of assume that you're, you know, the name's different. And most people don't even know what I am until I tell them now. So, and I can do an hour without even talking about it, and it's not an issue anymore. I think a couple of years ago.
Because that used to be a big part of what you did.
A couple of years ago, I felt like I had to address it because mm-hmm. people were curious. And now, I don't know if it's just the way America's changed or my confidence on stage. I don't really even need to talk about it anymore. I can if I want to, but it's kind of cool to be able to not have to do that.
So you were going to answer for Aaron, but you said nothing about him. So we'll let Aaron tell us what he's up to these days.
I'm going
to
take every single one of his answers. So I think that works. No, what Paul said, we're working very hard to be, I guess, relatable and human beings on mm-hmm. stage. So it is kind of a weird criticism when you're not over the top. There is a performance aspect to it. So you want to deliver, you want to be entertaining. But if that's not who you are at your core, it does come across as kind of phony. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to be, you know, superficially, you know, zany, you know, if that's not who you are.
I think I'm more comfortable in my skin now than I was 2 years ago. Like I used to be, I'm still getting nervous, but like I'm cool with doing my set. And if they don't laugh, I'm cool with that. Like this is what I do. Mm-hmm. I think I'm good at it. I've been paid for it for a while. So this is what I do. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But I mean, it still bothers me, but it's not like, I think I'm proficient at what I do. And 2 years ago, I was like, am I going to be making a living next year? Am I going to be making a living next year? And I've been thinking of that for the last 6 years. I should just accept it at this point. So that's kind of how I look at it now. I'm like, okay, I know what I'm doing.
Is this full-time for you now?
Yeah, it's been full-time since 05. Mm-hmm. So, and I've been panicking since 05. Every year, I'm like, is this the last year I'm going to be doing it? And then now this year, I finally was like, okay, I think I'm going to stick around for a while. This is what I do. This is what I'm good at. And I think it shows on stage now, so just confidence-wise. So I don't know about him, but.
I think, I'm definitely feeling more. And just not necessarily full-time, but over the last year or so, it's felt like I've just had way more opportunities now, way more new experiences in front of different audiences in different cities. And so I felt like a real validation, I think, in the last just 4 months, 6 months. I mean, there's always going to be that constant question. Can I keep doing this? Mm-hmm. You know, am I wasting my time or is there a future? But there've been a lot of, you know, little accomplishments along the way that feel like I'm building up to something, you know, a bit bigger.
Well, I thought about you in particular, Aaron, because you have a wife and a family. I mean, it's a lot of sacrifice of time for you.
Yeah, it is.
First call, Aaron's wife.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me tell you.
My whole struggle has been is finding some sort of balance, is finding what, you know, how to balance earning a living and balance traveling, because I'm traveling a whole lot more now, and then making sure that I do spend the time at home or do the family stuff. And schedules have never been more important. You know, if something's booked, something's booked. And, you know, if one thing drops, then, everything gets messed up. So we got to be very, very careful, you know.
So, you know, there's been all this research the past few years about the 10,000 hours, you know, the genius factor and all that. And I don't know if you guys are at 10,000 hours of writing and rehearsing and practicing, but you've got to be close to it. And I'm wondering what you can just understand about what you're doing yourself that maybe you didn't get, couldn't recognize when you first started doing this, even if you had some talent to begin with, you just didn't see it.
You go.
Okay, I'll go. Yeah. I think specifically within the last 2 years, I mean, I've taken more classes. I've taken, you know, voiceover classes, acting classes, improvisational theater classes, everything to help me gain more confidence and get looser on stage. And it helps with not just performance, but also with writing. You know, you start doing little improv scenes and you kind of figure out what the beats are to a scene and you figure out what's going to drive something. So I'm not just worried about a one-liner anymore. I'm trying to see an act come together and I'm trying to find the funny wherever I can, you know. And I've done a lot of development, I think, outside of stand-up that's really helped, you know, as far as introspection and figuring, you know, just stuff out on my own. And it's really, and I'm not just focused on stand-up anymore. I'm also looking at, you know, scripts and writing sketches and just trying to, you know, broaden, you know, as much as I can.
I was on this crazy college tour. It ended on Monday. Did like 70 cities in like 100 days kind of thing.
That sounds awful.
It was awful.
Exhilarating, but
I mean,
awful.
Well, travel-wise, it's hell. Mm-hmm. And I think comics like kind of glorify it because like, oh, you're on the road that much. It's incredibly difficult. But you do an hour every night by yourself. And over like about probably 40 shows in, I start to realize that this hour is like, it's hard to engage people for an hour.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
It's a lot of material.
Especially when you're not a name, when they don't know you. They're judging you minute one through minute 60 because they don't know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
But to be able to do an hour that for, 70, 80 days in a row, you start to feel like, and this is something that I never knew before. I just thought you wrote 60 minutes of jokes and then you just said them. Not that I have a theme with my hour, but like it feels... It's a different skill set than doing 20 minutes or 30 minutes. It's like you're taking them on a ride where at the end of it, it's something that I didn't... What I'm saying is I used to just write material and just throw it out there and thought it would stick. After doing an hour repeatedly, you start to realize, okay, this is like me. This is like... it's a different event. You've got to pace. You've got to bring them on the ride. You've got to like soften them. You've got to like tickle them for a bit. Then you can throw this out. And I never knew that. Nobody ever tells you that. Nobody's going to tell you how to work an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to do it until I did it consistently every day for 80 days or 70 days.
So. Yeah, it almost sounds like you could kind of graph the energy that you have to manage throughout that
hour. It's impossible to completely destroy for 60 minutes in a row to people who don't know you. Like they're going to take breathers and they're not going to laugh at this one as hard as this one. And that's something you don't know until you do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
And living with material that long too, you also discover new things about it. That's what I like about it too, is it's a stupid realization because it shouldn't be such a big revelation. But the idea that it's my material, I get to say when it's done,
yeah,
you know, it's not done, you know? Mm-hmm. So if I've been doing a bit for 6 months or a year or 2 years and I discover something new about it, a whole new angle, then that's the fun part is trying to breathe new life into something and find something new and exciting about it.
They always say, like, I was worried about that. I would get tired of my act on the road, and I never did. And it was because of the same thing. Like every time I'm doing it, my brain's still going to see if I can throw something new in there that I haven't done in 2 years or 3 years, or something just magically pops up, you know? And so every single time I do it, even though, you know, maybe audiences are sick of hearing the same jokes in my head, I'm still playing with it because it's my toy. I wrote it. I didn't take it from anybody. I can do whatever I want with it, you know? And so it was fun for me to do it. I mean, the travel was exhausting, but it's still fun to be able to play for an hour. And with an hour, you get to really play around because you have a lot of time. So, yeah, it's all new to me, kind of.
seems like there's a parallel in some ways between comedians, unlike other kinds of performers, and visual artists. You know, visual artists will obsess over one subject for, you know, 2 years. They're doing different iterations of the same thing, and then they finally get it right, and then they kind of sometimes just abruptly drop it and move on to something else. Yeah. I mean, do you all feel that way?
Well, I think it's great when you look at a comedian like Eddie Izzard, who goes to the same themes, you know, special after special. And you'll find that with a lot of, you know, big name comedians who you like, they'll talk about the same topic because that's what most excites them, that they're most fascinated by. But it's just a million variations on that theme. So you're talking about religion, or you're talking about family, you're talking about whatever. I'd compare that to, you know, a visual artist who's doing the same thing, just trying to squeeze the most out of any given topic.
It frustrates me, though, if I have a joke that I wrote 4 years ago, and all of a sudden, 4 years later, I come up with the perfect end to it. I'm like, why didn't I do that 4 years? Why didn't I come up with it 4 years ago? Like, what happened? That's frustrating for me, because then I'm like, I'm not using my brain enough past 4 years.
Do you understand that the place you have to be to write well? I mean, have you figured out, is there a formula for sitting down and really working on something?
My brain's constantly moving. Like, I have to, like, kind of shut it off. I don't know how to stop it. And so, but it's easier we write every now and again, but like now, especially being on the road by myself, I'm stuck with myself and I know how it works for me. I pace like crazy. I'm in a hotel room, I'm just pacing with my notebook out, and that's all how I know how to do it. I can't actually sit at a Starbucks because I just start staring at everybody, but that's how I write. It's kind of creepy, like, to see me pace around a room. That's what I do. But with these guys, it's you have somebody to piggyback off of, like, to throw ideas out. And what I like writing with Aaron is, like, he never shoots any of my ideas down. As dumb as they are, he plays with them. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, and it's cool to have somebody that comes from an improv background, like the whole yes and improvisational comedy.
Right, as opposed to that would never happen.
Yeah. I mean, he has said that a couple of times, but I'm like, go with me. Come on. You know, it's going somewhere, so.
So when you're writing together, do you write for one another, or are you writing for a project that you would work on, that you'd perform together?
The way that, I mean, it's fun having a group together with a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different points of view, because that's how you also get the most out of any given topic, is maybe there's a you know, an angle that I'm not going to think of. It's just not in my, you know, in my wheelhouse. But we'd sit around and like, all right, so what do you got? And then we all sit, you know, just pitch. This is the bit I've been thinking about. This is kind of where I want it to go. Yeah. This is what I think, you know, would make it really interesting. And then someone will throw out an idea for a tag or say, well, have you thought about that? And you're like, all right. And then there's a group of us that we'll keep taking credit for each other's act.
Yeah.
Night after night after night. You know, you see somebody on stage, you see your buddy kill with something. There's invariably going to be one of us in the back of the room whispering to somebody else, that's mine.
Yeah.
That's,
you know, like, so. For every single joke, every single one. But like what I love about it is because I've tried to write with other people outside of Aaron, our friend Jason and Mark and whatever. And people, comics get so like especially newer comics get so worried about, well, you wrote that for me, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. I want to write it on my own. I want to do it this way. But it's like, we're not stubborn in that sense. It's like, if I throw him an angle and he's like, well, I didn't think of it, and it kills, that's fine. I have more stuff in my head.
And there's nothing more generous from another comic, especially like a nationally touring guy, somebody who's coming through town, headliner, somebody you may respect, that somebody you've known since you were a kid, who actually watched your set and go, you know that bit? What if you did that? I mean, there's no better gift. You know, that's somebody giving you a killer ending to something.
Yep.
We're talking about comedy with professional comedians Aaron Aryanpour and Paul Varghese. They will be performing at the Backdoor Comedy Club on New Year's Eve. That's in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are comedians Paul Varghese and Aaron Aryanpour, both of whom will be performing at the Backdoor Comedy Club's New Year's Eve extravaganza on New Year's Eve, starting at 8 o'clock. If you would like to join the conversation, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I'm curious about this when you're watching other comedians on stage. I mean, when I watch an interview, even one that is great, I'm always aware of what the reporter, what the journalist is thinking about and what must have happened and what went wrong and what's happening in the back. Are you unable to watch comedy just for enjoyment's sake?
I still can. I love it. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of comics who can't watch it just because they're afraid of like their ideas, somebody else doing their ideas or stuff. And accidentally lifting ideas from watching comics. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the one thing that I don't have that filter. Like I don't watch somebody and go, that's a great bit, I'm going to take it, right? It doesn't creep into my subconscious. I love watching stand up. I still get a kick out of watching new comics, everything. I don't know when I'm going to lose it. Hopefully I don't lose it, but I'm not jaded from it. I enjoy it. I know the thinking process behind it. You know, I know how I watched Louis C.K.'s newest special, which came out, I think, 2 days ago online, and he released it online or whatever. And I know how his process is when he writes. I know that, but I still appreciate it for what it is.
Do you watch his show?
Yeah, it's awesome.
I think it's amazing.
Yeah, I'm surprised people who aren't comics get it, because it really is for comics. Like some of the things are so inside to just what stand-up is, and I'm surprised it's even on air. So, you know, I like it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't watch as much as I used to. I mean, I was a huge fan of stand-up, you know, and I don't know why that is, but it might be that exact thing where I guess I've pulled the curtain back and I kind of know what some of the tricks are. But that being said, I still really enjoy the show part of it. You know, even in the dinkiest place, you know, the idea of lights dimming and a spotlight on a stage and people clapping to something, I'm very much... It still excites me. It's still, you know, a lot of fun to be a part of.
I always watch because I want to be... I'm inspired by guys with really good... I'm inspired by a really good joke. Like, it makes me happy to see, like, smart comedy. It just... Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I'm kind of a nerd like that. But I love watching it. That's why I love watching open mics. I mean, these guys used to give me hell about just sitting there watching. I'm done, and I'm sitting in the room watching 10 open micers because I just like watching it. It's just fun to me.
So. It's not painful when they're having a really tough time.
No, because I've been there. Mm-hmm. I know exactly what it is. I mean, like we just talked about off air, like, you know, I got a show asking for their money back. I've been there. I know exactly.
So you performed and they said that was not funny.
I got a call on Monday from my college agent, and she goes, yeah, this school. She goes, what happened at Illinois State University? I'm like, okay, well, oh, hold on. And I just 30 minutes of just basically backpedaling and apologizing. But it was by far the worst show I've ever had.
What did happen?
I was in a gymnasium because I was in a gymnasium, which obviously is strike number one. And there was a Build-A-Bear workshop in the room next to it. So just kids would just leave like 2 minutes in.
Children are there.
No, these are college kids. They're 18. Which, yeah, and they're just leaving to go get bears, and they come back in, they leave, and just happened that way for about 20 minutes. Nobody can understand me because, you know, we're in a gymnasium. Mm-hmm. And about 30 minutes in, I was like, I can't do this anymore. I said that out loud. I think that's the one thing. I'm too comfortable now. I just say what's in my head, and I just told them that. I was like, I can't do this anymore, guys. Like, this sucks. And so I just got off, and then that's when I got the phone call on Monday.
So is there, I mean, are audiences just merciless? Because if I see someone, you know, in any sort of live performance, I feel the need to be a little bit supportive, even if I'm not that into what they're doing.
You're in the minority, though.
Really?
Very, yeah. Easy. Especially, goes back to when you're not a name, people really don't care. Like, mm-hmm. if they're not there to see you, they're judging you from minute one. I mean, a lot of those kids thought I was terrible, and just because they couldn't hear me, you know, so, you know.
That, I mean, there's so many little things that comics will pay really close attention to, and I think any performer will also pay attention to, but venue, height of ceilings, you know, there are all these, the way
acoustics.
The sounds, yeah. Acoustics, you know, the sound system, everything, and all sorts of factors that can play into whether or not an audience is going to enjoy you, you know, yeah. And that's before you even say one word. So, I mean, you try to make the best out of some of those situations. Sometimes you can't. You know, sometimes a room full of people decide they don't like you from the beginning and you're never going to change their mind. And then other times it's, you know, an amazing experience and, you know, you want to bottle that forever.
For me, like, I've been doing it, 10 years now? I think you've been doing 9, right?
9 and a half, yeah.
And I love the fact that we have similar war stories because we've been in situations together at terrible shows together. And we can always laugh about that. I mean, we did a show in Skokie, Illinois in 04. I think it was 04.
You should not go to Illinois, apparently.
Yeah, I've never had one good show in Illinois. It's a terrible state for me. But we did a show. There was like 1,100 seat theater and 40
people. Big, beautiful theater.
Yeah, beautiful.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. 40 people show up. And so I don't know if you've ever seen a room of 1,000 empty chairs, but it's really, really difficult. And we didn't book it. Like, somebody else booked it. He thought it was going to be huge. And that's like the most humbling thing ever. And I was telling Aaron, like, if I'm ever able to sell out a show in Skokie, Illinois, I'm still going to remember 7 years ago when 40 people showed up and I knew 30 of them, you know? So, but I love having that, like, that's something that only me and him know, you know, me and our friend Raj, but I love those kind of,
I do corporate shows all the time and I've done really good ones and I've done ones that, you know, haven't gone as well. I did a corporate show, at a certain, sport venue here in the Metroplex. And it sounded on paper like it'd be fantastic, you know, but I thought it was going to be in a conference room for 700 people in this venue. And it turns out it was on the mezzanine above the Western end zone. If that gives you an idea where this was. So there's 700 people in front of me and I'm on like a postage stamp size stage with like it's a fine enough sound system if you're going to play a band, you know, play music. But there's 80,000 empty seats behind me that everybody, and yeah, so no one's really going to hear you. No one's going to appreciate your subtle humor.
Well, it seems like even if they can hear you, if you have to use your voice in a totally different way than you normally would, then it throws you off.
Yeah, a little bit.
It's stand-up's one of the weird things, and I know this only just because of the college tour. It's people literally don't think about lighting or, hey, we shouldn't put you in a gymnasium. Like, that didn't even cross anybody's mind. It wasn't like, well, the conference room was booked. It was like, no, let's just put these guys and let's give them a microphone and let's see what happens. You know, like any, I don't know any other art form that would just let you just have at it. To me, it's like a complete lack of respect for the art.
Well, you could look at it that way, and I think you're probably right, but it's also people think you're magic, you know, right? People think you can just turn it on and that you just get up there. Do you meet people who don't think you've written stuff ahead of time?
I get it all the time. I'm always people like, hey, so how'd you just come up with that? You just walk up there and just come up with it? I'm like, I used to just argue.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Yeah. I used to argue, but then I was like, yeah, I'm really gifted. I don't stutter at all. It's amazing. So, yeah, I mean, people always think that you just make it up.
There was a poker night we did together years ago. It was like a Vegas themed thing at a country club. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
Where halfway through my set, I realized no one's paying attention because they don't care that I'm a comedian. I'm decoration. Mm-hmm. It was Vegas. So they're like, well, let's get some, you know, showgirls walking around. Let's have some poker tables. Let's have, hey, a comedian. And I realized in that particular instance, I was basically like a window cling. I was a decal.
So you were like the Shecky Green that they brought into.
I should have been. It was like a fathead of a Shecky Green. They weren't going to listen to me at all. I just happened to fit, you know. I don't remember if we even finished that one either. It
was, they got me off stage so they could play Cool in the Gang. Like, so they literally did. They told me, hey, sir, you can, you're done now. I get that a lot. I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. First, we'll speak with Daniel in Fort Worth. Hey, Daniel.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Yeah. Earlier, you all compared comedy to visual arts, but I was wondering if you all could talk about the improvisational aspect of comedy and how it relates to jazz. If at all.
No, I mean, it definitely does. I mean, I learn so much by studying improv, which is a totally different mind state than stand-up. Stand-up's a very negative mind state as far as, like, when you're writing, it's always, like, you're just reversing stuff. You're always slamming things. It's always critical, and improv's very, like loving and like supportive.
And you're building. You're building something at all times.
So, yeah. So I will improv if something happens in the audience or if like maybe my brain goes a certain way. And it is free form because you don't know where you're going with it. You know, you just kind of have to commit to it and just hope for the best, which is, you know, the best jazz is just them going for 70 minutes. It's almost like, you know, a solo, but you can't do that. You can't do 8 minutes of improv stand-up.
Some people do.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's nothing worse than somebody who's sticking to the script no matter what. You know, no matter what's going on in that audience, they don't refer to it. It is a conversation between you and the audience. And if the audience is telling you something with their laughs or their non-laughs, you kind of have to respond to it. So you do have to be, you know, somewhat nimble up there. And there was a great quote with Jerry Seinfeld, who said that bad audiences help you edit and good audiences help you explore. So there've been a number of times where I'm on stage and they're laughing and they're really in the moment. I'm really in the moment. And that's when the improv skills kick in and I'm going to throw out a line that I've never thrown out before, or I'm acting out a whole scene and they're loving it. And I'm totally excited about it. You know, it's something that really gets me going. And hopefully if it clicks, it's something that you can kind of recreate and do it again.
Live stand-up is way better than taped stand-up. Like, everybody who says they're like they're fans of stand-up but they just sit at home and watch DVDs, it's not even close to live. Live is so much better just because you don't know what's going to happen. There is that kind of trapeze, you know, kind of tightrope, you know, scenario to the whole thing, you know. I would love to see Louis C.K. live. I've never seen Louis C.K. live. I would love to see him live because you never know what's going to happen. Like, one of the biggest videos that went viral a few years ago was Bill Burr, who's one of our favorite comics. He was in Boston, Philadelphia, and he gets booed. And he just goes on this 8-minute rant of how he hates the city of Philadelphia. It's not a bit. He's never done the joke, and it went viral. It's what blew him up huge. And again, you wouldn't see that on a DVD. Like, you wouldn't plan that out. It wasn't like material. It just, they booed him, and he just lashed back, and it's beautiful. To me, it's beautiful.
So obviously when the audience is with you, it feels great and you're on this thing together and they're sort of part of the journey. But I wonder, you know, knowing that at least sometimes that's not going to happen for whatever reason, they had a bad day or they haven't had enough to drink or they just don't think you're funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have to start with a sort of benevolent attitude, like bless your little hearts, whether you like this or not, I'm going to do my best for you?
It depends on my mood. Sometimes I'll get, if I'm not in a good mood, I'll just talk down to them, and that's kind of an unprofessional thing to do. You know, sometimes you have to smile and just like kind of plug through it. But I take pride in the fact that I am who I am up there. So if I'm in a kind of a weird mood, it's going to come out that way. I never wanted to go into it. The reason I love doing stand-up is like, there's no boss. There's nobody telling me what to do. There's no HR. There's nothing. There's no performance evaluation at the end of it. I'm my own boss. And so if I'm in a bad mood and they're not digging it and I feel like I'm going to lash out, then I do. It's not the most professional thing, you know? And a lot of times I'll just be like, okay, I'm going to be professional and I'm going to be nice and I'll coddle you. But to me, again, live stand-up, you know, you're seeing somebody at their truest. You know?
And you should never make a judgment call like that until you're at least 2-3 bits in. You know what I mean? You go up there trying, and if they've determined that they're not going to, you know, sway one way or the other, you know, then yeah, all bets are off.
I mean, but, do you blame them or do you blame you if it doesn't go well?
I always blame me. I may say I blame them on stage, but I always blame. I know where I mess up. Every show that I've done, even the show with the Build-A-Bear workshop, I know where I messed up.
I would blame Build-A-Bear in that case.
I messed up accepting that gig. That's where I messed up. I messed up showing up to the venue. No, I know exactly where I mess up every single time on stage. Even when I have a show that's, I think, is close to flawless, I know exactly where I screwed up. So.
I think every comic does. I think every time that they come off, even if it's the best set ever, you're like, I really wish I hadn't said it that way, or I would do it. That's the great thing about it. You get to do it again, you know, so you always get to make improvements, you know.
And there's always a way to connect with every crowd, even if there's only two people there. There's a way to do it. It's a puzzle. And the more you go up, the more you can figure out how to do it. But, I mean, yeah. So.
That's what I like about it, too, is I discovered is that if people aren't laughing at something, maybe it's not that it's a bad thought or a bad bit yet, it's just I'm not finished or I haven't learned how to communicate it, because in my head there's a connection and obviously they're not seeing the connection, so I have a little bit more work to do.
I think, you know, we were talking about the 2 years, what have you learned in like 2 years, the last few years, whatever. I realized that I'm not funny. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I do a
was
joke,
it, you didn't get that before?
No, because I always was still like, am I funny? Is the crowd gonna like me? But now if they don't, I know I'm funny. Like, it's just I messed up in connecting, but I don't sit there and doubt myself and go, am I going to write a new bit? Am I good? Like, I have confidence in what I do.
Yeah,
like,
that is kind of an epiphany, I guess.
It's huge, because now you feel like, okay, this is what I do. And that's, I never really thought that until this year. So
let's go back to the phones now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak this time with Stephen in Dallas. Hey, Stephen.
Hi there, Chris. You're our jewel at North Texas.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you.
Thanks. I had a question for the guys about physicality and even if it's a nuanced type thing that they might do in their acts. And as an example, Ellen does this thing where she uses the whole stage in a bit about cell phone reception and ends up behind a imaginary trash can. So talk about physicality.
I absolutely love it. I think it's essential. And I try to do similar things too, where I use the stage as a set. And there are other times where I want to kind of keep it reeled in, and I'll get some mileage out of just an expression or just holding a look. And I recently did a gig just this last weekend where it was possibly like the largest venue I've ever performed for the largest audience. Mm-hmm. And there were no video screens. And so I was kind of panicked before that. Like, are they going to get the facial cues? Are they going to get that? So I'm going to have to exaggerate just a little bit, because I'm just going to get swallowed by that stage otherwise. So I'm going to have to pace a little bit more. I'm going to have to use the stage a little bit more, and I'm going to have to be a little bit overly expressive with my mannerisms. But yeah, I mean, it's an integral part to it. Anybody will tell you, if you've been doing this for a while, writing is essential, you know, good writing. But it doesn't mean anything if you can't perform it.
Mm-hmm. There's a thing in improv called show don't tell. And, the less words you can say, the more you can physically show, the better. Because I love not talking, if that makes any sense. Like, my whole set, I always tell them, my perfect set is me not saying a word for 45 minutes. I have a lot of jokes where I don't say anything. Mm-hmm. I'm just quiet. To me, that's physicality right there. You know, not saying anything and just, you know, dancing around.
We're speaking this hour with comedians Paul Varghese and Aaron Arianpour. They're performing at the Backdoor Comedy Club this New Year's Eve. That show starts at 8. You can find information about it online. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Paul Varghese and Aaron Arianpour. Both are comedians. They have toured all over the country, but they will be performing in Dallas at the Backdoor Comedy Club's New Year's Eve extravaganza on New Year's Eve. The event starts at 8 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. We have an email here from one Alan Arianpour, who says, you are his brother. He says, you have evolved in every way a person can since starting comedy.
Yeah. I don't know if that has anything to do with comedy or the fact that we just don't live in the same state anymore. So
your relationship is
wrong. Yeah, our relationships. we're not right on top of each other anymore, so we can appreciate each other better. He's easily one of the funniest people I know, he's very sweet, and he's not intentionally funny, but he's funny. But no, I think that any pursuit that makes you happy is going to help you be a better person, I hope. You know, it's something that you're passionate about, so you want to learn more. I think anytime that you're trying to learn about anything, if you're going to stay a student your whole life, then yeah, I think that helps make for a better life, makes you a better person. Not better than other people, a better version of yourself.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about, you know, when you talk about continuing to evolve and moving on, and I mean, I guess everybody wants to be well-known by everybody, but the reality is so many working artists, and Jose Bowen, the dean of the Meadows School of the Arts at SMU, is really adamant about this with his students, that the vast majority of successful art students are going to graduate, make a decent living for themselves, not be world famous, and sort of need to know how to manage a small business, which is themselves. And I wonder about that, and if there's a point at which you think, if it continues like this for the next 20 years, I'm great, or I can only be happy if I get to this, or do you have a point where you say, I turn around and it doesn't count unless I am this?
We talk about this all the time, because I get a lot of flack from comics for being in Dallas, for being based in Dallas. And I've been able to make a living, I'm not hugely rich or anything, whatever, but I've been able to make a living for 6 years, and I love, you know, I've experienced fame here, you know, I get recognized here, but it doesn't validate me. I don't see it as, I've never been like, wow, I'm famous, this is fun. There's cool things happen, but like, I'm totally happy with telling jokes and hanging with friends and touring across the country. And you can't control fame. That's the thing about it. You can't control if you're going to be a household name. You can't control if you're going to make millions. If I could, I obviously would have done that.
If anybody could, yeah, they would have sold the secret a long time ago, but you can't.
There's downsides to that too.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, I know just from a small level, like sometimes if I want to go to Walgreens and somebody recognizes me while I'm buying a Snapple and I'm in a really bad mood, and that's on a small level. That's a very, very small C-list local level. I can't even imagine how it is for, you know, huge names, you know, like just movie stars and stuff like that. But again, like, it's not like I'm not trying to be famous or successful. It's just, I enjoy doing stand-up. It's my job. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like, I mean, it's what I do. It doesn't validate me. It doesn't make me any more special or any more important. And fame's not really success to me. Fame doesn't really signify success.
I think fame translates to, it's like a means to a different end, where the more famous you are, the more of an audience you have, the more people are going to come out to see you, the longer I get to do this. That's mm-hmm. the way I look at it, is like, do I get to do this more in front of more people?
I think I also, I try not to listen to what comics tell me, because like a lot of comics, like there's huge, like Brian Regan's one of the biggest comics in the country, but a lot of comics will say, well, he's not like huge, huge. I'm like, he makes millions. How is he's not huge to you? Like, comics are always very critical. There's always going to be somebody who's not going to like this guy. He's not this famous. He's not this famous. You just kind of have to decide what's important to you. Which to me, I'm making money legally, you know,
yeah.
And I can pay my rent, and that's, I'm not content by any means, but you know, if I was doing this 20 years from now, yeah, I'd be fine. I'm sure, you know, my parents would be very upset that I don't have a retirement plan, but I'm happy with it, you know?
But, you know, a couple weeks ago, I spent like a whole week in Boston on a trip, and then I was back home for a few days. And before I left again to go out of town for a few more days, I was able to go to my son's school and have lunch with him. And it's like, if I could figure out how to do this like over and over again, then this is my definition of success, because mm-hmm. I've just been somewhere and I had a great time. I'm on my way someplace else. I'm going to make some money. And while I'm here, while I'm home, I'm present, and this is me being happy, you know? So it was good to experience that.
Me and my sister talk about it a lot. My sister's a priest. And mm-hmm. so she's always like, you know, obviously everything's.
Does she tell jokes, by the way, in her homilies?
She says she does, but I don't really like her sense of humor is like, I mean, she's really, really, she's easily the funniest person I've ever met. Mm-hmm. But I can't imagine, I mean, it's priest humor.
Well, so. You got to be careful, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. But we always talk about, like, you have to define success. Like, you're never going to be famous enough. The most famous comic in the world is never going to be as famous as the most famous athlete in the world. Mm-hmm. You're never going to make enough money. Somebody's always making more money than you. And so you just have to decide what's important to you. And for me, it's being able to make a living and hang out with friends and family and for me, it is. I mean, I don't know. It's different for different people, but I think a lot of people think being a millionaire and being worldwide famous is the only way to be a success, and I don't really see that.
That's the other thing I've had to learn, too, over the last couple of years. If you're waiting for some other title or amount or any kind of marker to be happy, then you're never going to be happy. So, yeah. And there's a difference, too, between, you know, finding happiness and then being complacent. You mm-hmm. know, like, you can be happy now and still not be
growing.
Yeah, and yeah. Still want just a little bit more, mm-hmm. you know? So.
It's one thing I learned about going on the road with him is he has really good balance because he has a family, he's got a career, everything else, you know, and another job as well. And it's just me solo, you know, doing stand-up. And I used to be so driven and focused on it that it became kind of selfish. It's like, you can't just be by your, to me, you know what I mean? Like, there has to be a balance of like friends and being around different people and being just different important things. I see that with him because I've just been by myself all this time. And then, you know, you realize when you travel so much, you're like, okay, there needs to be something else. It can't just be 100%, you know, I've got to be famous, you know, because it's just a shallow way to live. You know, it really is. It's kind of really superficial and shallow, you know, so.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Joshua in Denton. Hey, Joshua.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Well, I just had a quick question. I'm actually interested in going to do some local stand-up, I guess, open mic. And what I was interested in is how they came around to finding their style, I guess, as comedians, instead of just going on and trying to say, like, I think they'll think this is funny, or do they say what they think is funny, you know, and kind of the bumps in the road that they got in the beginning, just trying to, you know, make people laugh.
You know, for the record, I recommend everybody give it a shot at one point in their life. Just get up on stage, whether it's karaoke, stand-up, whatever. Just get up there and just experience that. You never know. You may just light up, you know. But I think what's funny is that you walk into it. I mean, everybody knows what's funny. Everybody has their own sense of humor. And there are things that they think that they don't have to learn. They go up with a preconceived idea, I know I did, of what's going to be funny. And it takes a long time to kind of learn that that's not quite it. Mm-hmm. And maybe I can do this, maybe I can do that. So it's not something that's going to click right away. You do your best, and then you constantly refine. You constantly try to figure that out. And hopefully, the more you do that, the closer you get to your more or your most authentic self. I mean, the funny guy that you are, the funny girl that you are in your kitchen at a house party or when the friends and the family are all together, if you can somehow get to that with a room full of strangers, then that's it. That's how you do it.
I don't think I've found my voice yet. I haven't had that epiphany where it's like, wow, all this material is going to flow out because I found where I'm at. I still go up there and I throw out what I think. What's funny to me. I used to throw out when I first started, you always throw out what you think they're going to laugh at. Mm-hmm. And now going back to the confidence thing, I just throw out what I think is funny. If they don't laugh, it's like, okay, well, it doesn't work, but it doesn't mean I'm not funny. But when you first start, you need that validation. Why else would you go up if you didn't want them to laugh? So you kind of, you don't really pander, but you throw what you think is going to work.
It's a fine line. You don't write only for that audience. It has to come from you. Otherwise, it's not an artistic pursuit at all. You know what I mean? That's a very cynical way to look at it. Well, I'm going to do this only because they laugh. And there's some very successful people who do stuff that you know it's not in their heart, but they're getting laughs at it, and they're, you know, making money off of it, and they're hollow inside. You know it. You know they're hollow inside.
I mean, in the same way that there are people from the audience that are going to look at this as an art form, and there are people who are going to, you know, they need to kill 2 hours doing something they think is fun. Are there comedians who are really don't see this as an art form and are just sort of there to
a lot of them. Yeah. I mean, we're also raised in a scene. Dallas is very comedy nerdy, so we love the comics. Literally sit around and just talk about jokes and how to, like, is this word funny? What if I put this word over here? Like, it's really, really nerdy. And I love that. I love that. But yeah, even a lot of the really successful ones, I don't think they look at it as an art form. It's like, I just say this and I fall down on stage and everybody laughs, and I don't think they're analyzing it, you know. That's why I love seeing Louis C.K. talk about stand-up, because he's just as nerdy as all of us about it. Seinfeld's the same way. But those are the minority of, I think, because I've been on the road and I've talked to comics when I've worked with them, and they don't analyze it as much as I do. So I just kind of keep my mouth shut. You know, I can only talk about it with these guys. Everybody else is like, why are you analyzing that word? I'm like, it's funny. And then I just shut up and leave, you know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to, let's see here. Let's go to Corey in Dallas. Hey, Corey. I guess we don't have Corey. All right. I will move on to my next question. When it comes to like a New Year's Eve show, and I found out, by the way, there are two shows. You probably both already knew this. There's one at 8 and one at 10:30.
I didn't want to interrupt earlier. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I said it like three times. But anyway, apologies to Linda Stogner and the folks at Backdoor. There are two shows, which I know you have to reserve ahead of time to get a seat and all that.
Right.
I was going to ask about, like, is a New Year's audience different somehow? Are they... do they have different expectations than typical Saturday night?
I think, to me, I'm always the last guy. So I'm always the guy who's, when they start handing out the noisemakers, mm-hmm. I'm that guy. So, yeah, exactly. But and for a lot of them, New Year's Eve obviously brings out the rookies. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who don't really go out that time. But we have a really good following now. Over the last few years, we built a really good following. So most of those people who are coming out there know who we are. Mm-hmm. And they're really supportive. And, like, I've had the most fun at those New Year's shows.
They're great shows. Yeah. And, you know, it's a full lineup of a lot of different types of comics. And it's like that. I suggest if you haven't been to a show, go out. Go see live comedy. Support it. You know, seek us out. Seek anybody out. And just to experience it. Because there's a lot of different voices here in Dallas, in Fort Worth, And the New Year's Eve show, it's always fun because people are out there determined to have a good time, you know? They're there to laugh.
You're not going to mess this up.
Yeah, exactly. As a comedian, it's yours to mess up. You know, they're there. They want to laugh. They want to drink, you know? They want their champagne. And so it's as a holiday itself, too, it's a great time to kind of look at all the things that made you laugh over the last year, you know, and take a look at some things like... joke-wise, too, things that you don't like about yourself, that you don't think about it as, in terms of resolutions, but things that you're going to change in the future, that kind of stuff. So it's...
You know, and the show itself, I mean, it's basically PG/maybe PG-13 at the mm-hmm. worst, and that's... It just brings in a different kind of clientele. I mean, it's a classy night out, you know what I mean? And I think that's what everybody wants for New Year's as is. And there's so many different comics on that show. There's maybe 8 or 10 comics. And so if you don't like one, just wait 5 minutes. There's another one. And that's a cool thing. I think at the other comedy clubs, there's only maybe 2 or 3 comics going up. So if you don't enjoy that guy, you're kind of stuck with that guy and New Year's Eve is ruined. At least here, you can wait 5 minutes and get it back.
Well, you guys are so collegial and I know you're close friends. I mean, I wonder about the competition, you know, when you're somewhere and there are multiple people and there might be somebody you like and somebody you think is horrible and how you sort of negotiate that
as far as like performing
or yeah whatever. I mean are you I mean there are decisions to be made about who goes when mm-hmm. right
yeah
don't take our friendliness for lack of fight because I think that our goal is to make it as hard for the next guy as possible mm-hmm. like it's that kind of friendly competition where I want to burn it to the ground. I want to have an amazing set and make the next guy sweat mm-hmm. just a little bit.
You want to be the guy who when people come up after the show, they go, well, you know what? You should have been the last guy. That other guy, that brown guy couldn't do anything. I don't know why he should have went before you. That's what you want. And I think we've all had that in separate moments. We've all done shows where he's stolen it from me or I've stolen it from him. But like, I'm not taking his material. He's not taking my material, but the show should be, I think the show gets elevated. I mean, for me, if he destroys, I have to destroy.
And then the audience wins. We all win.
Yeah.
You know?
Sounds fantastic. Well, guys, it's always a pleasure to have you here. I really, really appreciate you making the time.
No, thanks for having us.
Paul Varghese has been called best stand-up comic in Dallas by the Dallas Observer. Aaron Arianpour is currently a finalist in the Funniest Comic in Texas competition. You can see them both and a number of other noted comedians at a special show on New Year's Eve. There is one at 8 o'clock and one at 10:30 at the Backdoor Comedy Club in Dallas. Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, you can send those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.